Hi, Lisa. Welcome to our podcast. This is the Big Unlock podcast, and we have, 185 plus episodes. This is season 6. A very warm welcome to all our listeners as well. So my name is Ritu M. Oberoi. I'm the co-host here at the Big Unlock podcast, usually joined by Rohit as well, but he couldn't make it today. I'm the managing partner here at Big Rio and Demo Consulting, and also the co-host of the Big Unlock podcast. So really glad to have you on our show today. So today we are joined by Lisa Hunter, Senior Director of Federal Policy and Advocacy at the United States of CARE, an organization dedicated to ensuring that every American has access to affordable, high-quality healthcare, regardless of where they live or who they are. And with that, I'll hand it over to you, Lisa, for your introduction, and then we can get started. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Ritu. And thank you also for the work that you and Rohit have been doing on the Big Unlock. You guys are addressing a lot of the issues and highlighting some important discussion points in this like very dynamic moment in the healthcare system. So thank you for having us today. United States of CARE is a relatively new organization. We're based out of Washington, D.C., but we have staff across the entire United States. I oversee the federal work, both the policy side and the advocacy side for United States of CARE. And as you had just described, our organization is really looking at improving the healthcare system and transforming it so that it really, at the end of the day, works for everyday people in the United States. And so my personal background is I have been in the advocacy space for about 6 or 7 years now. Prior to that, had done healthcare consulting. And so understanding the Affordable Care Act and the implications and the real world sort of operational pieces of that for systems, payers, pharmaceutical companies, et cetera. And then prior to that, had started my career in public service, both in Congress and then at the Department of Health and Human Services. So I come to this having seen a lot of changes over the last 2 decades within the healthcare space. And I'm excited to see where this conversation leads us as we are about to embark on some new changes that are coming down the pike as a result of recent legislation, including the Rural Health Transformation Program. So happy to be here, really excited to engage, and looking forward to see where the conversation leads.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lisa. We always enjoy these conversations because, you know, every single conversation we learn something new. And like you said, every C-suite leader we've talked to feels that healthcare in America right now is at a generational, you know, transformation point. And they feel this is, with AI and with everybody trying to improve the, you know, patient journey, they feel that this is like a seminal moment where, you know, a lot of things are coming together, converging for, you know, real change to happen. And everyone's really excited about it. Also, because usually healthcare has been, you know, famous for being the slowest to adapt to new technologies. But now if you go to HIMSS or any of these healthcare conferences, all you see is, you know, AI everywhere. And you feel that everybody's really embracing this, you know, faster change, and they're ready for it. And they're ready to really transform how, you know, care is delivered across America. So we would love to hear about the new act and what you've been talking about, the rural bill. So, you know, tell us a little bit more about that and how you're working across all of America to get this across out to the places that need it the most.
Absolutely. And I think what would help is to do a little bit of table setting, which is, I think many of the C-suite leaders that you've been talking to are very keyed in on the promise of AI. I think as an organization, we're following the AI sort of issue from the consumer and patient and everyday person perspective. And yeah. I think one of the things that's occurred to us in the advocacy community is that the voice of patients and the voice of people is somewhat missing from the table right now. Part of this is because AI is such a massively complex issue that a lot of the advocacy organizations, I think, are frankly putting out a lot of fires in their own traditional coverage buckets or affordability work streams, all very important work to be tackling. But what we've been doing at United States of CARE is we've been doing some listening work and research. We have, when I say listening research, I really mean PhD level qualitative and quantitative research on AI and introducing AI into healthcare. What does it mean for people? And so I'm happy to share those materials after the recording for your listeners. But one thing that I think we are starting to see in how people are perceiving AI in healthcare is that there's a real trust deficit. And so whereas industry, both the tech industry and the healthcare industry, are looking for ways to bring efficiency into the system, help improve the healthcare experience for people, we are seeing a lag in terms of the patient perspective and, frankly, the trust that they have in adopting new technologies and AI into their healthcare. And so we're looking to do more research on this as the field is evolving, which is happening very rapidly, but certainly are also very cognizant of the fact that this new administration and under Administrator Oz, we know that there's a huge impulse to figure out a way to adapt AI and bring AI into the fold into Medicare, Medicaid programs, et cetera. The Rural Health Transformation Programs that was just introduced in July. So as your listeners may have noticed, for the first half of this year, Congress went through a reconciliation process to make massive changes within the healthcare system, largely directed at the Medicaid program. However, in this massive bill that was signed into law in July, was established a provision that started a program called the Rural Health Transformation Program. This is $50 billion over the span of 5 years that 50 states are able to apply to CMS in order to receive funding. I can describe a little bit of how the funding breaks down, but big picture, the Rural Health Transformation Fund is something that I think many people are looking at as a real opportunity for doing something big to really bring solutions to the rural health infrastructure and make improvements so that rural health across America can certainly live out its potential to address health inequities, reach populations that have for a long time been difficult to reach, and really inject a new life and opportunity in rural America when it comes to healthcare. So this is a huge investment, and we are living through a really rapid timeline with it, but happy to take this in whatever direction would be of most interest.
Yeah. So lots to unpack there. And I think the first thing that you talked about, you know, the trust deficit, I think that's something we hear often because we are always hearing about, you know, responsible AI, trustworthy AI, and especially now with deepfakes and, you know, things being able to be manipulated so easily with AI. It's very hard for people to tell what's real and what's not even real anymore. So how can you leave it to people's judgment to find out what's like? There has to be some basic trustworthiness to this whole process. So yeah, we hear that a lot. And I think that's on top of everybody's minds. But at the same time, we would be really interested to hear your take on, you know, how do you balance that? Like, so how do you balance innovation? You're not trying to stifle innovation or hold back innovation. You want to get innovation to the, you know, rural populations, like you said, but at the same time, how, in terms of policies or, you know, from your point of view, how do you balance that with encouraging, you know, trustworthy AI? So on one side, you have rapid innovation in which, you know, risks and, you know, that's a part of the ballgame. And on the other hand, you want this complete trustworthiness, which only comes with time and with taking things slow. So how do you, like, as a policymaker, balance out those two things?
That's a hard question to answer right now, because there's not enough research to tell us exactly how you bridge the trust gap. I think there needs to be more research that identifies where are the major deficits versus the major opportunities. Our initial research into this shows that, you know, I hate to sort of like boil it down to this, but what our research shows is that the closer that AI gets to like a human body, the more uncomfortable that person is. And so we find in our research that a lot of the folks that we had talked to in focus groups and what we found in some polling research has shown that there is a general comfort around certain use cases that are like ambient listening inside a doctor's office or the potential for doing sort of back office functions. But the closer that you get to introducing AI into, in some ways, what might be seen as sort of subverting or supplanting the actual physician in the room, that is when people become more and more uncomfortable. In conversations that we have with policymakers right now, I think they're really eager to figure out a way to bridge this gap. I think they're also seeing, especially in this administration, there's a ton of effort going into modernizing our healthcare system, right? We have a whole bunch of folks who are bringing some serious technical AI credentials into the administration when it comes to healthcare. And we're looking to make investments in AI and healthcare in our healthcare system from the point of the policymaker. But what good is spending all this money on integrating AI into these systems if people aren't going to use them? Not just people, but providers aren't going to use them. And so how do you address that? I think I wish I had the sort of like silver bullet answer for you on how do you bridge this? I think it's going to take more research. One of the things that we're interested in doing is more use case sort of research, using it for certain radiology, using it for certain drugs, using it for who knows what, and looking at different use cases and seeing if there's a way to make that information relevant for policymakers so that they can understand how to either tiptoe into this or more strategically fold AI into reforms. But at the end of the day, I think our major push is we certainly don't see ourselves as wanting to stifle innovation. We want to see responsible AI, which I know can be a term that is sort of used a lot lately. And we believe that there are conscientious ways to be integrating AI on behalf of patients and consumers and people. So that is sort of the perspective that we come to this issue on.
Great answer. Thank you, Lisa. I think that makes a lot of sense. That's how it should be. You know, you have to keep the overall big picture in mind and really strike that fine balance between the two. And like you said, it's not like it's not easy. It's not going to be easy, but you have to get started and you have to, you know, hope that you get there eventually.
Yeah. And I think the other piece of this where some peer organizations are trying to do some work is also understanding the trust deficit on the part of the provider, right? I think we're coming at it from the patient perspective, but the provider piece of this is also really important for adoption too. So very cognizant of the full field, very difficult space to be working in the moment, but exciting and dynamic. And we see a lot of opportunity here.
Yeah. So we've, you know, seen the same trend as well, because we, like we said, in all our conversations with the C-suite leaders, we've now seen, you know, AI ethics, AI governance coming to the forefront. We are seeing people form these, you know, ethics and governance boards within their organizations. So everyone's definitely becoming more cognizant of the fact that it's here to stay. And this is how you have to, like, you know, work with it and find out a way to implement it within your organization.
Absolutely.
Okay. So that leads right into my next question. So like you said, your work focuses on, you know, ensuring that policy decisions reflect people's real experiences. And like you said, you know, you're seeing that you're doing the research, you're seeing that people are getting uncomfortable when AI is getting very close to them, maybe for diagnosis or for things that they believe that should be, you know, still within the domain of a physician. So how do you and your team bring those voices, patients, families, and communities into these federal policy decisions? How do you make sure that, you know, everybody's heard and everybody has a seat at the table? Like, we would love to hear more about that.
This happens a few ways. So I oversee our federal team. And so the audiences that we are engaging with on these issues include Congress, so members of Congress on the Hill. And then the other piece of this is policymakers and regulators within the federal government on the administration side, so CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I have a counterpart within United States of Care who oversees state work. And so they are engaging similarly with state lawmakers, state regulators on some of these issues. And both of us are also engaging with partners. So whether that's think tanks, whether that is industry leaders, whether that is other consumer advocacy organizations or national voices in the healthcare space. And then the way that I direct our federal engagement on these issues is largely educational. Members of Congress are juggling quite a lot, and it's not just in the healthcare field. They're looking at national security, they're looking at the economy, and you know, in some ways there's a lot of a Venn diagram going on here. Education, all of these things. Their healthcare staff are also juggling a lot of balls in the air. And so it is important that we get in these rooms and have conversations with congressional staff to share with them what we're seeing in terms of the data and the research that is showing up on AI. And frankly, we listen to people not just on AI, but on a whole host of things. And so for your listeners, I think AI is certainly a topic of interest. Another topic of interest is value-based care, or patient-first care is what we call it. And that really comes down to the financing of healthcare and how our healthcare system is set up on a fee-for-service basis, where we, you know, there are a lot of issues there that we're trying to address. And like, when we're talking about an organization like ours that's trying to transform healthcare, this is one of the ways that we have to do it. We have to go to the root causes of some of the payment incentives and reimbursement structures that are causing a lot of friction within the healthcare system for beneficiaries, for everyday people, for consumers, et cetera. So we talk to congressional staff. We also talk to leadership at CMS. We talk to the civil servants at CMS, and we share with them the data that we're seeing and what we're picking up in the field throughout our listening work. And the other thing that we do is not just listen to patients' perspectives and translate that into policy. We also do some messaging research too, because the other thing that our organization has learned is you can put together the prettiest, most resonant white paper with the solution to fix healthcare, but it won't go very far if you don't have a way to talk about it. And so language and messaging really matters. I think this is true both for AI and for value-based care. And one of the things that I will just share is something that we've been talking about for a couple of years now is our research was really clear when we talked to people about the fee-for-service system versus a value-based care system. We didn't use those terms. We just described what they are like. And yeah. What we learned is the word value is a huge turnoff to patients, to consumers, to everyday people. When they hear the word value, even if it's couched in a term like value-based care, they immediately assume it's like a bargain bin healthcare deal. So something like, I wouldn't get bargain bin, I don't know, paper towels. I wouldn't get bargain bin bacon. I want the Oscar Mayer, right? I want the brand name. And so yes. This is how we've sort of rebranded value-based care and talked about it as patient-first care. But folks can use whatever euphemisms they want. As long as they don't say value, I think you're in the clear. Yeah. And so we share those kinds of insights with policymakers too, precisely to get at the, you can have the best policy solutions, but you need to be able to talk about them in a way that resonates with people. And so those are the two most direct ways that we're able to bridge that divide between policy and policymaking.
Okay, great answer. I think this is a really good insight. I think we're going to use this as one of the key highlights of the podcast.
Oh, great.
Patient-based care rather than value-based care. You know, that's so amazing. I think we use these terms so often that we kind of don't understand the impact that they're having on the general consumer or the patient population. But like you're saying, if you really sit down and listen to them, then you learn something valuable. And this is like, I think, a very key insight. So we're going to definitely use this. Thank you.
Yeah. And if I can riff on this for just a second, we did some listening research where we described a fee-for-service system and described a value-based care system. So like a model of care. And what we found is by a margin of 4-1, people preferred the characteristics around a value-based care system or patient-first care model. And so that is hard quantitative data that helps underscore our position on this, which is don't call it value. And people want their care coordinated. People want to have more time with their doctor and not in the waiting room. People want to see that their providers are talking to one another. They want whole patient care. They don't want to be just given a pill for every symptom that they have. They want to be treated as a whole person. And so when you talk about it in these sorts of terms, it really resonates with people, as opposed to sort of like the cafeteria style, like healthcare that you get in a fragmented fee-for-service system. I think related to the Rural Health Transformation Fund, this has been a very tricky transformation to achieve in rural America. So traditionally, our system is based on fee-for-service, which is frankly just like volume-based care, paying providers based on the number of services, the number of visits, but not actually paying for the quality of care that's delivered. And what's, I think, evaded rural communities across the country in changing their payment models and really going all in on a patient-first care type of system is upfront investment. And so when we were talking about earlier, the Rural Health Transformation Program, $50 billion, all 50 states are eligible. DC is not a state, DC is not eligible, and the territories are not eligible. I should asterisk that. Across 50 states, if 50 states get an approved application, each of them gets an equal share of the first half of that funding. And that can be really transformational in certain communities where patient-first care models are just not possible simply because upfront investment hasn't been available. Well, guess what? If these states that are applying for funding actually start to see money come in, get an approval from CMS and start seeing money coming in the door, they are finally going to be able to break through this barrier of upfront investment to be catalyzing payment models that are actually going to be sustainable, that are going to better serve rural communities and be more reliable and dependent, frankly, in a system where I think a lot of the trouble with rural communities and rural healthcare is that I think there's distance issues, there are technological issues and barriers, there are fears that hospital wings are closing or hospitals are closing altogether, right? All of these things sort of collide. But if you're able to optimize the use of this funding as a state with a lot of rural healthcare needs, the upfront investments in order to lay the groundwork for patient first care models is actually a really transformational thing that can do what the entire provision of this program wants to do, which is transform rural healthcare.
Yeah, that would be amazing if that happens. Looks like you guys are doing really good work. I was just thinking of this book that I just started reading over the weekend, and you might find it interesting. It's called Lifespan by David Sinclair. I don't know if you've heard about it. He's from Harvard Medical School, and he describes a lot of what you've been talking about, patient first care, and, you know, about, he's actually compared the health system models of, you know, the US versus Australia and the UK and Canada. It's a really interesting read, and he's kind of tried to analyze how we've gotten to where we are with the American healthcare system and what we can do to kind of fix it. So I think what you're describing is a giant first step to really get the care to, you know, the people who need it. And on the same kind of trajectory, I also wanted to tell you a little bit about, you know, what we've been seeing with our venture studio, where we've been trying to incubate companies which, you know, really bring this AI first model of healthcare. And one of our companies is trying to provide remote, you know, AI based healthcare for ophthalmology. And the doctor is from Alaska, and he always tells us the same thing, that, you know, Alaska, there's just not enough physicians out there. It's such a huge state with, and most of the people who live in this, you know, rural geography are just not able to access care. So if you can use AI or other tools to really bring the care to people who need it, it could be very transformational. So
absolutely,
put it out there. Yeah.
Alaska's an interesting state too, because they have a lot of Alaska Native populations, and IHS, the Indian Health Service, is very prevalent as a provider there. They don't just serve Alaska Natives, they also serve non-Alaska Natives as well. And I think I'd be curious to know, I think one of the things that has long evaded policymakers in the United States has been around broadband, right? And making sure that broadband's available. And unfortunately, I mean, there's a whole list of prohibitions tied to this funding. And so some of the things that are not allowed are like uses of capital on things like broadband, but it does allow for and tries to incentivize. I mean, in fact, you know, there are some specific goals set out in this fund, one of them being technological innovation is like a clear aim of this program, and transformational healthcare, new delivery system models. And both have a lot of promise within this funding opportunity. I do think, though, there are still, it's interesting that you mentioned ophthalmology and the fact that this provider has said that there just aren't enough doctors. I think that speaks to not just an Alaska issue, but an issue that has stymied rural communities across the country as well. One of the themes that we've been trying to capture is, what are state applications starting to show in terms of what they're going after? The application from states, so CMS issued a notice of funding opportunity and asked for a lot of information in a very short amount of time. So states were like racing the clock to get an application in by November 5th, and we're only a few days out. And so I think we're still in this assessment mode and analysis mode where we're trying to understand what was in all of these 50 applications. But a couple of little breadcrumbs that we were able to capture along the last few weeks has been, workforce has been an issue that a lot of states have either asked for public comment on as they were putting together their applications, or are including into their applications writ large, as well as also, actually, we did see some payment innovation and patient first care model interest in applications too. So all of that is good. Data interoperability was also an issue, which is another thing that takes a lot of upfront investment. And so hopefully we'll start to see some of that really turn a corner under this program.
Great. So, Lisa, I think we almost reached the end of the podcast now. So I want to ask you, you've spent a lot of your career at this intersection of policy advocacy and public service. What keeps you motivated and what advice would you give young professionals who are entering, health policy or advocacy? How would you tell them to stay optimistic? And where do you think the most change is going to happen, like in terms of timeline? How soon do you think, change is coming? And any final closing thoughts, we would love to hear from you.
So that's a big question. What keeps me motivated is, I hate to be so squishy and fuzzy about it, but I have two little girls and one of them has a childhood asthma, right? And so I think about her and I think about the engagement that I've had to manage between multiple specialists in order to keep her healthy and maintain her condition. And when I think about them, I think about there is no greater honor than to do whatever I can to make the healthcare system better on their behalf, but also on the behalf of millions of Americans who are also managing chronic conditions or having difficulty navigating a really complex system. And so I almost feel like it is a duty and a responsibility to be doing everything I can to remove as much harm from the system and remove as much friction from the system for the betterment of future generations. I also belong to the sandwich generation, if you're familiar with that phrase. Yes. So,
absolutely. Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And so, it's so funny. My parents are aging. They're on Medicare and my dad just got onto a GLP-1 and you're seeing the results of that. And so I actually think the innovation and the promise of where healthcare and medicine can go, that's pretty optimistic to me, right? And in some ways, I'm seeing what the real-time benefits of what this is having on his life. And so for a lot of reasons, I feel personally invested in this. And I would say for any person in their early in their career in this field, whether you're in health advocacy, whether you're at a health system, wherever, I think one thing that has occurred to me is that nobody goes into this field, nobody goes into the healthcare sector trying to do bad. Everybody is trying to do good. And my hope is that to the best of everyone's ability, that the patient is always at the center of focus. And that won't always align with a sort of profit-driven entity. However, for folks who are contributing in their careers to bettering the healthcare system, to the best of your ability, just centering the patient, centering everyday people, and coming to the table with ideas that brings those voices forward is going to do a lot to hopefully keep that at the center of future policymaking and future places where the sector is going to take us and industry will take us.
Great. I think this has been a really insightful and engaging conversation. Thank you so much, Lisa. It was our pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.